What I'd like to share with you today is 19 years of experience I've had trying to grow canola on the southern Great Plains of the United States. And I have many authors, and many of them you know, Calvin Trossel and Sangu Angadi have been very active with this organization and continue to do extremely good work. And I'm going to repeat something that Sangu said earlier. The reason we need canola is not for the canola oil in the part of the world where we live on the lower Great Plains. It's for the cows we have. If you look at Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, New Mexico, and Kansas, they produce nearly 20 million beef animals annually, and that's just short of 50% of the U.S. total. We have a growing dairy industry that's fleeing California and environmental regulations at an alarming rate and coming out where it's pretty dry, but no environmental regulations. And so there is just a growing and huge demand for oilseed products. I'd like to start with a map today, and I'm going to talk about three areas that impact you, Zone 1, Zone 2, and Zone 3. And I'm talking about the areas of Oklahoma, Lower Kansas, Colorado, and New Mexico primarily, because I really haven't done that much extensive plot work up north of there. But we're going to talk about those three zones. The first zone is from 96 to 100 degrees west longitude. We call it the rolling plains, and there are some topography in that area. It gets anywhere from 20 to 26 inches of rainfall. And in those conditions, kind of like typical around Vernon or central Oklahoma, rain-fed and supplemental irrigations, we can get from 1,600 to 3,600 pounds of yield. And that's why the interest in Oklahoma and canola. If you move up to the panhandle of Texas from 100 to 102 degrees west longitude, we have 20 inches on the eastern side of that. It narrows down to about 14 inches just before you get to Clovis. And you nearly need supplemental irrigation year in and year out to make the crop. But when we do make a crop, it can be 2,200 to 3,600 pounds, similar to what Don just reported in eastern Oregon. And then you go from 102 to 109 degrees west longitude, which is southern Colorado and the mountain valleys of New Mexico. That's nearly all totally irrigated, and it's grown on a spot-to-spot basis. And so to tell you about my sad life, I've decided to make it a game show. And you're lucky my daughter couldn't find the audio tape that said Wheel of Fortune. But I'm going to tell you about the Wheel of Fortune, the Southern Great Plains Canola Production Edition. Research at Texas Tech University and Texas AgriLife in New Mexico State has worked on several factors which can limit the successful production of winter canola. I would like to invite you to play this little game with me, and you too can learn how to successfully grow canola in this region. I moved to Lubbock, Texas in 1991. In the fall of 1991-92, I planted my first crop of canola on, this is a true statement, a Pullman clay loam. And the soil we have, Jack, at Moscow, Idaho, is a Pullman clay loam. And I thought I'd died and gone to Hammond. It actually, this is how mean Mother Nature can be, okay? We had a great crop. No insects, no pests. It was on our animal science location where we dumped manure. We didn't need fertilizer or anything. Harvested between 2,800 in the low treatments and 4,000 pounds of seed. I thought, okay, the canola king has moved south. And then the Wheel of Fortune started, okay? The next summer was a very dry summer. There was no moisture for seed germination. So the growers that I talked into found the Rape King. I lost $30 per acre to establish the acres, then had loose soil blowing around all winter. And that can be solved because we get excellent emergence with sprinkler irrigation or subsurface drip irrigation. And I'd got out and preached the merits of this as a dryland crop, okay? And this is a crop we seeded this last fall. Michael's still here, this is the NT National Variety Trial there. And this is on 40-inch center, 8 inches deep, subsurface drip irrigation. And canola loves drip irrigation. And we love drip irrigation in Texas because we don't lose any of the water. And water's what it's all about. The next year, spun the wheel again, beautiful stand of canola. We had a very dry winter. The growers that were still out there listening to me, and there weren't very many at this time, okay, lost $80 an acre to pumping cost. And it's hard to make a profit on canola when you've supported your local electrical cooperative at the tune of $80 per acre. If we could genetically improve drought and winter hardiness so we could get through those drier winters, it would help us. The next year, the purple aphid showed up, and you guys in Canada probably don't have purple aphids, but we do in South Texas. And the purple aphids came for spring break and stayed into Memorial Day. And first I had to get a herbicide registered in the state, insecticide registered in the state of Texas, and then I had to get an applicator, and then I was in the city limits, and by the time I got done, the purple aphids were fat and my crop was gone. So, but my growers that were out of town lost 30 acres, $30 per acre for pest control. And two ways would help that: more host plant resistance to the cabbage aphid and more registered pesticides south of the 49th parallel. The next year, we had a great crop, beautiful crop, canola. Then I had to go find a trucker and a processor. And this was before Oklahoma would process canola. And so we were back hauling clear up, in some cases, to Fargo, North Dakota. Okay, so we lost $30 per acre minimally if we found a closed processor and transportation costs. And so I was delighted when the plants in Oklahoma City agreed to crush canola. That's just a 8-hour drive instead of a 28-hour drive. And so it made it much more reasonable. So we needed to develop regional oilseed processing. Once we have a processor dedicated to oilseed crops, real oilseed crops, not cotton, okay, we need to encourage that. Then there was another year, this was an exec sequence, we had a beautiful stand of canola and excellent moisture, and then the far west turned black, and hail destroyed the whole crop, okay? Didn't have to harvest, so we lost $150 an acre, few growers I had left. This is dwindling, you understand, so I've got less than the disciples left at this time. And we lost $150 an acre in production cost. And we need to genetically enhance shattering resistance in all of our forms of canola. However, in a West Texas hailstorm, it will flatten fits. So sometimes you're just not going to get around that. The next year, I talked to the Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, my good friend Pete Laney. That's 45 miles north of me. He had thought, come by the farm, thought, boy, this is hot stuff. I'm going to grow some of that canola. So I gave him some, and we had a beautiful crop, went all year, and 3 days before we harvested, the wind blew out of the west continuously for three straight days. And just before harvest, we had a complete crop loss. So our spin of the dial that time, well, it was $230 per acre, and we decided we'd work on new crops. And we had a special research funding that Pete was going to carry to the state legislature. We didn't get that. New crops were too risky. I will say this, though. If you ever shatter a 3,000-pound canola crop, you will grow mourning dove that are about the size of small turkeys. When we do get a beautiful crop canola, and that's about one out of 4 years, and we have a reasonable trucker and the Oklahoma processing plant, we can make about $230 an acre. With the new hybrids and selective herbicide resistance, what they offer in higher yields, we could expect in the near future to make $360 an acre. One of my projects I work on is cotton, and Bob Nichols came from Cotton Incorporated. We have growers, one grower in particular, that sold his entire cotton crop he harvested this year for $1.28 a pound. I can guarantee you that the cotton-producing regions of Texas will not grow an acre of canola next year, because that's just impossible to compete with. And so I'd like to thank you finally learned how to grow canola. But if our regional processor goes out of business in a bad year, we lose a very viable industry. And again, I reflect back on the animal industry and the need for the high-protein meal. Okay? And so I'm going to give you just a couple slides on spring sesame, winter safflower, and canola quality camelina that could enhance our regional processing capability. Sesame is a crop I'd never seen really grown extensively to this last year. And it's a very drought-tolerant crop. Our seed yields vary anywhere from 500 pounds per acre to 2,000 pounds per acre. Right now, the market is buying that sesame seed at 35 cents a pound, raw seed. Okay, oil contents, I didn't know this till they borrowed my NMR, and it varies from 49 to, I got some more assays today, 56%. So it's got very high oil content. It's 47% oleic and 40% linoleic, which we've heard in earlier talks, is a good fatty ester mix for an edible oil. We do have problems with stand establishment, weed control, because there are no chemicals registered for weed control on sesame. And the relatively low yields that our dry land growers that don't put any inputs into it can achieve. Advantage, it's very drought tolerant, and it's extremely well adapted to the western United States. This is sesame on our irrigated farm, and you can see why I'm in the city limits. Most aerial applicators do not like to fly over a subdivision or a trailer court to deliver ethyl methyl parathion. So. And this is sesame in stand right there. We also have shattering resistant varieties now and a dwarf growth habit that allows fully mechanized harvest. So you have establishment, cultivation, hopefully in the near future some registered herbicides, and then harvest. And that's what our dryland growers are counting on because it's such a hard crop production area. Winter safflower. This is work I started at Idaho, and Dr. Johnson over at Pullman continued in while I was being a department chair. And there are spring wheat and winter wheat. And where you can grow the two together, winter wheat always nearly out-yields spring wheat. And we did identified 8 accessions that overwinter, both at Moscow, Idaho, Pullman, Washington, and also down in Texas. And our seed yield could be anywhere from 500 to 3,000 pounds per acre, again, depending on winter moisture. However, there's a fly in ointment because a really good accession of winter safflower has 34% oil. My local processor at Oklahoma City doesn't want to crush a 34% oil seed crop. So we're in the process of crossing spring types that have 42 to 45% oil, and also spring types that have high oleic, up to 80% oleic acid in the oil. Disadvantages is once you get past the eastern boundary of the Texas Panhandle and the humidity gets to above 90%, foliar diseases really impact safflower. Safflower is just a dry climate without humidity, and so the Texas Panhandle is about as far east as you can go. It's very drought tolerant and salt tolerant, and it's well adapted to the western United States. The other thing that I like about it is, if you are planting wheat, you can vacuum out your drill, open up the drill, and look for safflower, make the setting there, pour in your safflower seed, and you're off planting. Same planting machinery, not same herbicides, but same harvesting equipment. When you get ready to combine it, you get out your manual and learn how to set your concaves, and you're off doing it. And we need a crop in our wheat production areas that uses the same equipment base. The other thing that we discovered, and this was entirely by accident, we have an area on the lower Pecos River where there is 250,000 acres of laser-leveled land with wells on it, irrigation ditches in place that have been abandoned, and they grow tumbleweeds, nice tumbleweeds, and salt bush. And you can see this didn't snow in this safflower nursery. This is the salt accumulation on the soil. The other thing I'd like to encourage someone in this group to do, because I'm not going to live this much longer, is to develop a canola quality winter camelina. And the reason I would like to do that is because we are putting in drip irrigation. Right now we have over 300,000 acres and probably putting in the rate of 250,000 acres a year in our production area because it's such an efficient way to grow cotton. But if we could get a short season oil seed seeded after the cotton and harvested before we plant the cotton, it would really help pay for the expensive capital input into irrigation. So I need someone to make a canola quality camelina. However, I hate to grit Jack about anything, but I grit Jack right now with high glucosinolates and that fatty acid composition, that low oil, we don't want to mess with camelina until it's been worked on. So. The other crop I'm working with is a castor, and it's the bad boy of oilseed crops. It has an allergen and a ricin toxin. It produces 85 to 90% ricinolenic acid. And I'm sure one of your grandmothers or elderly aunts chased you around the room with a spoonful of castor oil and says, take this, you will feel better. And you didn't feel better, okay? That same laxative property makes it a very valuable industrial oil market, and it also makes an excellent biofuel. I make the statement, qualified, of any temperately adapted oilseed crop, castor produces the most oil per acre, and we've been very pleased with it. But however, I have to tell you, and I asked Jack to grow a trial for me, it's the best way I know to get to know your local FBI agents on a first name basis. I'd like to acknowledge the people. I'm sorry I didn't have a formal experiment to present to you, but I wanted to give you kind of a 20-year overview. Chevron Technology Ventures and Texas A&M Bioenergy Alliance have helped fund this research. I have a Sun grant that we're working on, the winter safflower. Sangu, who's here in the audience, is a co-PI on that. The USDA and Texas AgriLife, the U.S. Canola Association gave us some money, and I have the vestige of having the longest funding of anybody in this room from the U.S. Canola Association. So I would like to thank you for your diligence while I learned to play Wheel of Fortune. And Dr. Travis Miller is my boss at Texas A&M, and it's kind of strange, at least it was last Saturday, to have Texas Tech play Texas A&M and have a joint appointment with both institutions in football. In addition to that, the Rockwell Chair, which helps fund my dalliance in science and my idiosyncrasies, helps fund some of this research. Thank you very much.